It is Wednesday, October 21st, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, the leaders of Syria and Russia meet in Moscow to discuss the Russian military campaign that's backing the forces of Damascus. Thousands of migrants enter Slovenia from Croatia and Serbia.
This morning, there were over 2,000 people that were waiting to come in into Croatia from Serbia. Majority of them are from Syria, Afghanistan, and Iraq. Desperate people.
And we'll see what the film Back to the Future 2 got right and got wrong about life today. It's all ahead. In his first trip abroad since 2011, embattled Syrian President Bashar al-Assad traveled to Moscow Tuesday to meet his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin. During the one-day visit made public Wednesday, Mr. Assad thanked the Russian leader for his military support, which began late last month, and said terrorism could have been more widespread and more harmful if it weren't for your decisions and steps. Mr. Putin offered to help with a political solution to end the civil war in Syria in close coordination with other world powers as well as countries in the region. The surprise meeting occurred as Moscow and the United States signed a memorandum of understanding to ensure air safety as both countries conduct military strikes against terrorist targets in Syria. The Russian leader, in remarks Tuesday to military and intelligence officials, said Moscow's intervention in Syria demonstrates it can counter any terrorist threats to the Russian Federation. He also revealed that Russia has foiled at least 20 terror plots in the country this year, arrested hundreds of suspected militants, and killed more than 100 others in the North Caucasus. Russia analyst Leslie Templeman-Holmes of Australia's University of Melbourne tells VOA's Victor Beattie Mr. Putin's tough rhetoric is aimed at an international audience and is part of the theme of his foreign policy to place Russia back on the world stage as a major power.
That message is designed to go out to a much broader audience than just the military. The audience is not even just the Russian population, it's the whole world.
The United States and Russia signed what's called a Memorandum of Understanding establishing air safety measures in their ongoing airstrikes in the skies over Syria. Is this a U.S. tacit acknowledgement that Russia is here to stay in the region?
Not necessarily that it's there to stay, but it's certainly there right now, and there need to be safety measures adopted and agreed upon. The trouble is that the Russians have been, if not explicitly and deliberately avoiding those, they've certainly been missing some of the measures that they haven't been adopting the measures as well as they should have done. Twice now they've flown over Turkey and the Turkish authorities, and of course Turkey has the second largest military in NATO, feel that the Russians are not abiding by the agreement to stick to certain areas and to agree with the West, with NATO and the US, on where Russian aircraft are going to be targeting.
Mr. Putin, in his remarks on Tuesday, said the Islamic State militants are planning to expand from their Syrian foothold and destabilize other regions. Does that suggest that Russia is expanding its anti-terror threat, perhaps to other areas?
Absolutely, but when you say other areas, we've got to include what the Russians often call the near abroad. In other words, it's not just into Iraq and other areas in the Middle East, but also into Central Asia. We have to bear in mind that ISIS is basically a Sunni movement, and the dominant Islamic movement in both Russia and in most Central Asia is Sunni. So Russia is sending out a message not only to IS within the Middle East, but to potential terrorists, particularly Sunni terrorists, in Russia and in Central Asia, in Kazakhstan and Kyrgyzstan and so on.
As you know, of course, Russia's engaged in conflict in Chechnya. Do you expect that its presence in Syria will inflame Muslim activism within Russia?
Unfortunately, I do see that as a real possibility. Chechnya now has a strongman leader, someone who's very close to Putin, and that regime can increase the rather authoritarian ways of dealing with potential terrorism. I can see the Chechen rebels becoming stronger and certainly wanting to challenge the authorities more in the future.
To underscore that, Mr. Putin said Russia has foiled some 20 militant attacks this year.
Oh, if anything, that's probably a low figure. 20 attacks foiled, there are probably far more that haven't been detected and that might be in the planning stage. The Russians have had various problems, not only in Chechnya, but actually in Moscow itself over recent years, some of which have been directly linked to Islamic terrorists. There's no question that the Russian authorities and the Russian military is very powerful, but we all know, the West knows just as well as Russia, that there are forms of Islamic terrorism that all the intelligence in the world simply cannot foil. I mean, the most obvious examples are lone wolf ones, and although I haven't seen evidence of much evidence at all of lone wolf type attacks in Russia, I see every possibility that these will emerge in the future.
That's Leslie Templeman Holmes of the University of Melbourne. He says Mr. Putin's rhetoric on terrorism has raised the risks of Russia itself becoming a terrorist target again. Well, now for social media reaction to this news, I'm joined by International Edition's Olin Akishalu. Olin, what has the reaction been?
Thank you, Sarah. Well, today the phrases Putin in Moscow and Bashar al-Assad were trending here in the U.S. on Twitter, and Facebook had identified it as a trending topic earlier today. There's a pretty mixed reaction to the meeting. It's very similar to what we've seen around other recent developments with Russia's involvement in Syria. I actually read some comments from people questioning why this is news, given that the two countries are pretty strong allies. But you have people on both sides praising Russia for stepping up its involvement against terrorism. People are also criticizing Assad because they say he's the reason for all the violence in Syria in the first place. People are certainly talking about the visit, but the conversation really isn't that different than what people have been saying about it in recent days.
What else is trending?
Something else that's trending worldwide on Twitter this morning was hashtag Back to the Future. And that's in reference to a very popular movie. And it's trending because today, October 21st, 2015, is the day that the main character Marty McFly actually arrives in future California. There are a lot of articles floating around comparing how 2015 was portrayed in the movie with how we live today, talking about what it got right and what it didn't. According to the movie, we're supposed to have hoverboards, flying cars, video chatting, and even some self-tying shoelaces. A lot of people are sharing a screenshot from the movie showing the famous DeLorean's dashboard reading today's date. Some people are posting photos of DeLoreans, and some people are drawing their own comparisons between today and 1985, like newspaper headlines, clothing. I actually saw one post comparing police officer uniforms between 1985 and today. It was pretty funny. And another worldwide trend right now is hashtag Netanyahu. Now, this morning, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu made some comments suggesting a World War II-era Palestinian leader, Haj Amin al-Husseini, convinced the Nazis to pursue exterminating European Jews. And he's getting a lot of negative feedback on social media for this statement that a lot of people say is inaccurate. He's getting accused of trivializing the Holocaust and possibly inflaming the recent wave of violence in Israel.
Well, thanks very much, Olin. That is International Edition's Olin Akishalu. This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
Over the past few years, researchers have made tremendous strides in making prosthetic hands more lifelike. While scientists are getting close to making artificial hands perform as well as natural hands, one area that remains a challenge is replicating the sense of touch. Engineers at California's Stanford University answered that challenge and have created a plastic skin that can detect how hard it is being pressed and then produce an electric signal that will provide that sensory response directly to a living brain cell. The skin is made with two layers of plastic. The top layer acts as an input device that senses the touch and the intensity of the touch. The bottom layer is like an electronic circuit board that sends electrical signals and converts them into biochemical stimuli that are compatible with nerve cells. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear about Back to the Future 2. Thousands of asylum seekers have entered Slovenia since Saturday, forcing the country to deal with a surge of migration on its southern border. Slovenian authorities say at least 4,000 migrants, including many babies and young children, arrived Tuesday from Croatia, in addition to about 8,000 migrants who arrived on Monday. I spoke with Babar Baluš. He's the spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. He spoke with me from Budapest. At the moment, what is this situation like? And I believe you were on the Slovene-Croatia border just last weekend. What is it like?
Yes, as UNHCR is present on all the border points, it's chaotic. Now we are seeing that more people are being stuck at the Croatian-Serbian border. This morning there were over 2,000 people that were waiting to come into Croatia from Serbia. Majority of them are from Syria, Afghanistan and Iraq, desperate people. And it's the same situation on the Croatian-Slovenian border as well. Since the rerouting of this movement, when Hungary closed its border, now more people are coming from Croatia towards Slovenia and then entering Austria and Germany. And so far, since this weekend, we have had over 20,000 people who have entered Slovenia from Croatia.
So their ultimate destination then, I guess, is either Austria or Germany?
Yes. I mean, the way we have seen these people, this population moving, they land in Greece through the Aegean Sea. So far this year, we have seen more than 500,000 people arriving in Greece, and then they move on, Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, Slovenia, and onwards.
Well, now, Slovenia is a small country. It only has, I believe, 2.2 million people. How are they able to deal with this influx of people?
They say they can't, and they say their resources are overstretched. Even yesterday, there were 10,000 people that crossed Croatia into Slovenia. They're struggling in terms of dealing with this population reception and registering them and accommodation as well. And then the same population is on the move through Austria. I mean, we have been trying to help authorities in all countries, starting from Greece, Macedonia, Serbia, Croatia, and Slovenia as well, and onwards. But it's a challenging job to do. It's winter. I mean, a lot of them are women and children. It's a desperate situation.
I was just going to ask that because it is the colder months are approaching, and it must be very, very difficult for people, particularly those with small children or people who are ill or disabled, to be able to move.
It is very challenging for those people as well, but also for us as UNHCR, a humanitarian agency. We need to run from one border to another location in terms of providing them blankets, raincoats, food, water, and everything. Our challenges increase every day, and as these people are at times left at the border point stuck, it just becomes impossible for them to survive.
Okay, well, thank you very much for speaking with me today.
Thank you.
That's Babar Baluš, the spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. He's based in Budapest. Well, here in the United States, the government has committed to admitting 10,000 Syrian refugees. Elizabeth Lee reports from Long Beach, California. One refugee group says more needs to be done to help refugees resettle to prevent further suffering and future social problems.
Many Cambodian refugees settled in Long Beach, California 35 years ago.
So I was told that freedom and opportunity was the key in coming here. But certainly what we weren't prepared of is the language gap.
Sarah Polim did not speak English when she arrived in the United States at age 14. The horror of watching her three brothers die in the Khmer Rouge genocide still fresh in her mind.
The last one that died in his sleep with me on the ground was the memorable moment how he was trying to survive, right? Trying to see if I hold on to life a little longer, maybe there's some grand, you know, freedom.
Many of the refugees did see freedom in Long Beach, but with its own challenges. Cambodian community activist Chan Hobson lists some of them.
Nobody think about or pay attention to our mental health at all. They give us the help with the basic necessary to survive physically. But emotionally, psychologically, and mentally, we did not have that.
Many of the adult genocide survivors suffered post-traumatic stress disorder. Many women had lost their husbands and sons in Cambodia. Many of their children had to care and fend for themselves.
Now we're seeing a transmission of trauma to to second and third generation.
Even till now, they have chronic illness or some physical disability because of it. And I think those are the reasons why we're still struggling and we're still trying to survive. People can't get jobs because of those things.
Sophia Chum works with youth who share her background, American-born children of Cambodian refugees. Higher education is often unattainable because poverty plagues the Cambodian-American community. Alicia Sim says poverty caused her brother to steal a car and get deported.
He started by stealing food, but then it got bigger. He started stealing car parts just to have a car for us to take us to places.
There's actually not a lot of support services, health services, academic services that actually help the refugees who first come to this country in order for them to be able to take care of themselves and their families.
Some of the refugees formed their own groups to help fill the need. Chen Hopson co-founded the Khmer Parent Association with her husband to help Cambodian families navigate the U.S. education system. She says the past failures in the resettlement process don't have to be repeated if more help is provided for new refugees.
Emotionally, psychologically, mentally, physically, socially.
Allowing the next wave of refugees to heal and be better prepared for a new life in the U.S. Elizabeth Lee for VOA News, Long Beach.
This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
This is International Edition. Movie fans 26 years ago saw a film that sparked the imagination of what life might just be like a couple of decades into the future. The day in that movie is here, and so is International Edition's Jim Stevenson.
October 21st, 2015. This is the day in the movie Back to the Future 2 when the main character Marty McFly, played by Michael J. Fox, arrives in the future from 1989. Now, many fans of the movie have been waiting for this actual day to arrive, and now that we are in the future, what did the movie get right in predicting our current life, and where did it fall a little short?
The future.
To start, the headsets worn at the dinner table resemble what we know as Google Glass and a few other competitors. Flat-screen TVs are a reality, as is video conferencing through computers and smartphones.
Hey, stop! Little girl, stop! Look, I need to borrow your hoverboard.
Where is it?
Yes, there's that matter of the hoverboard, a skateboard that floats on air, but not water, as Marty finds out when he's being chased.
Hey, McFly, you bojo! Huh?
Don't burst Star Wars on water!
Unless you've got power!
By the way, car company Lexus recently introduced a hoverboard that utilizes magnets and superconductors to defy gravity. It even emits steam due to the science behind the superconductors at work. The Lexus model won't be for sale, though, but this development does lay the groundwork for future hoverboard technology to eventually become a reality. Flying cars? Not even the fancy DeLorean that brought Marty to 2015 is off the ground today, although there are some manufacturers now vying to develop cars with wings.
This is a video game! I got it working!
My dad taught me about these.
It is Wild Gunman.
How do you play this thing?
I'll show you, kid. I'm a crack shot at this.
Your hands? That's like a baby's toy.
In a humorous moment, Marty saunters over to show some young kids how to play an ancient video game until they totally diss his skills. Perhaps there's a local arcade near you that features vintage games you could pump some quarters into and give it a try. One of the boldest predictions from the movie, the Chicago Cubs beat a team from Miami to win baseball's World Series for the first time in more than a century. You know, in 1989, there wasn't even a team in Miami, as there is now. And the Cubs are in baseball's playoffs right now, close to reaching the World Series. We'll have to wait for that to play out and see if Back to the Future got that right. Back to the Future 2 is indeed back. It's in theaters today to mark the occasion. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington.
I might have to go watch that. I'm embarrassed to say I never saw that movie. Well, along with Back to the Future 2, another popular movie from decades ago has a new installment. Star Wars is back with The Force Awakens, and ticket sales are setting records. And on this October 21st, we say happy birthday to Carrie Fisher, who we know as Princess Leia in the original Star Wars trilogy. She's 58 years young. That's our show. Please visit our website at voanews.com. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In its annual Religious Freedom Report to the U.S. Congress, the Department of State noted three strong trends in 2014. First, the most egregious and violent cases of persecution based on religious intolerance were perpetrated by violent extremist groups, who seem to be bent on eliminating any religious practice that differs from their narrow and violent ideologies. Second, some governments failed or were unable to protect their populations from abuse by such violent groups. And finally, some governments restricted religious practice or speech through the use of discriminatory laws, as well as arbitrary arrest, imprisonment, even execution. Around the world, a number of violent extremist organizations sought to murder or enslave any group or individual not conforming to their narrow interpretation of religious precepts. This included, among others, Daesh, Al-Qaeda, Al-Shabaab, and Boko Haram. The damage done by such groups was exacerbated by the failure of some governments to act quickly enough or at all to protect the victims. Some governments claimed to be the protector of religious minorities, but failed or were unable to stop religiously motivated extremist attacks. Others failed to prevent, stop, investigate, prosecute, or punish religiously motivated violence, creating a culture of impunity. Worse still, a number of governments passed and enforced laws that punished religious minorities or discriminated against certain religious groups. Laws against blasphemy and apostasy were used to persecute and exact grossly excessive punishments, up to and including death, in the name of protecting majority religions from insult. Still other governments persecuted and punished practitioners of certain religions under the guise of combating extremism and terrorism, or force religious groups to officially register and abide by a very narrow set of regulatory laws. Religious bigotry is present to a degree in every continent and every country, and sadly, even including our own. It may be expressed through anti-Semitism or prejudice against Muslims, through the persecution of Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, Sikhs, and others. Or it may come in the guise of attacks against religion itself, said Secretary of State John Kerry in his introduction to the Religious Freedom Report. By issuing this report, we hope to give governments an added incentive to honor the rights and the dignity of their citizens.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.